do, I'd love to hear some initial observations from our text in Mark chapter 15. What a sweet thing it is to be talking and teaching through this text over Easter. When was this? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting that after he was beaten, they gave him back his clothes, only to take them away later and auction them off, or dice them off. Yes. So there's
putting on all of the robes
and yep.
Treating him as a king, quote.
Yeah.
So there was a lot.
Yep. So Mark, who is typically brief, spends a lot of time explaining how they mocked him.
You know, it was interesting too that what nation that is under
sure. Yeah, this oppressed nation is turning their problem over to the oppressors. We'll speak about that in a minute. Anything else?
I find it interesting how much Pilate cares about what the crowd cares about.
Yes, he cares about the crowd. We'll talk about that in a second, too. No. Yeah, we can talk about that.
He's not going to answer questions today.
The question was, can we talk in detail about what scourging is?
So it's interesting how every little thing that he predicted was exactly.
Yes, every little thing that he predicted happened. There's a lot of places of fulfillment in this text.
Talked about the end times, how different things were going to happen, how that kind of parallels what happened during the trial and
yep.
The crucifixion and everything that carried out.
Yeah, there's a miniature end times fulfillment in how things happen. All right, well, our text starts out in Mark 15, and immediately we see the chief priests held the consultation, and they led him and delivered him over to Pilate. This is the first time that we meet this guy named Pilate. And as you probably know, the Jews could not administer the death penalty, especially for religious crimes. And so they conjure up a different kind of crime and hand him over to Caesar, hoping that Caesar will take their accusations seriously. I'm sorry, I'm saying Caesar. It's Pilate. Handing him over to Pilate. And Pilate's an interesting character. Historians have gone back and forth over whether he was a coward or whether he was a savvy political leader. And after doing some research, I tend to land on the savvy political leader end of things. And here's why. I'll give you a brief biography of Pilate. Pilate was kind of maybe the closest equivalent to kind of a medieval times knight, except for Rome. And so he was put in a position of power by a friend, and so he was put over this Middle Eastern area, which was a very important and yet also a very tumultuous place for Rome. The Jews were constantly rebelling. We have the Maccabean Revolt, which happened 100 years or so before this. We have random zealots Barabbas was a follower of one of these zealots who rebelled and caused trouble. And so this was a particularly troublesome place that took someone who's politically savvy and skilled to rule over it. So that kind of sets the stage for Pilate. Now Pilate comes in, and at this point in time, he's already had some minor squabbles with the Jews that made required some armed enforcement and putting down of some minor riots. So he's already had a couple strikes against him. Add that to the fact that he's no longer in good graces. The guy who his political friend whom he supported backed the wrong guy for emperor. And as what happens when you try to take over and go for emperor of Rome and you lose, it's not like losing the primaries, right? So Pilate kind of backed the wrong opponent. And so while he's still in power, he's got two strikes against him, and he's out of grace because his superiors are no longer people that he has good relationships with. So now we enter into this time of feasting of the Jewish holidays. So there's already a little bit of tension. And then you have these Jewish leaders who come in and hand over this guy and say, hey, this guy wants to be king. The implication is he's one of these zealots who's setting himself up against Rome. So Pilate interviews Jesus, and he's asking him about all of these accusations that the Jews are bringing up against him. And what's Jesus say? Yeah, he doesn't say anything until Pilate directly addresses him. He says, are you the king of the Jews? And he says, you have said so. That is an intentionally ambiguous answer. Jesus, we know, is actually the true king of the Jews. But he doesn't come out and say that because he's not coming as a political ruler. He's not that kind of Messiah. And yet he's also not going to deny the truth of Pilate's words. And so he intentionally leaves this somewhat ambiguous. And Pilate realizes pretty quickly, this is not the typical zealot, rabble-rouser, claimant to the throne that usually gets dragged before him. And if you're Pilate at this point, you're starting to think, ruh-roh. Because he's put in a really hard spot. He can either condemn this innocent person to death, or he can stand with Jesus and then have the Jews kind of go above him in the chain of command and accuse Pilate and say, hey, this guy has somebody who's causing insurrection and claiming to be against Rome, and he's not concerned. It would put the Jews in the position of being more concerned about Roman rule than Pilate. And so the Jewish Sanhedrin have really set this up in kind of a win-win situation for them. Either way, they're going to get rid of one of their political opponents. They'll either get to kick Pilate out, which would be temporary, but a morale boost for the Jews, or they get rid of Jesus, their kind of number one religious opponent. And so Pilate's faced with the choice. Do I condemn an innocent man, or do I face down the Jews and suffer the political falling out that's going to come from this? So Pilate comes up with this great scheme. He says, you know, every year we release one of these Jewish insurrectionists as a peace offering, an olive branch, so to speak, to the people. And so he says, hey, why don't we why don't we release Barabbas? Now, we don't have a ton of detail about who Barabbas is, but we know, Mark tells us that he had committed murder in the insurrection, and so he is likely one of these Jewish zealots. We have a mention of a historical event in Acts chapter 5, where there's an insurrection and the leader is put to death and all of his followers are put in chains. Barabbas is likely one of those followers who rose up against Roman rule and killed a man and is now in prison. And the Jews, the chief priests and the scribes, stir the crowd up to demand not Jesus being released, but Barabbas. Now, why do you think that's significant? Why do you think Mark spends so much time on that?
Somebody who is really guilty who's being freed by the death of Jesus.
Somebody who is really guilty is being freed by the death of Jesus. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. This is a picture of the gospel. This is a picture of someone who's truly guilty of setting themselves up against the rightful ruler of the land, and has committed unspeakable crimes, and who is unapologetically guilty, is now being set free. Friends, this is a picture of the gospel. It might make us a little bit uncomfortable because we would rather identify with the lame guy in Mark chapter 2 who has much faith and is forgiven. We'd much rather be that guy. But the reality is, you and I are much closer to Barabbas. We ourselves have set up our own hearts against the Lord and his throne. We are the rebels who are guilty of treason against the Most High God. We are the Barabbases. And we are only freed because somebody has taken our place. That is Jesus. This is Mark's use of pictures, real life pictures, kind of coming on full display, and it's going to happen two more times in our text. So, Barabbas, a picture of the gospel. Pilate ultimately cares more for the reign of Caesar and the intent to keep the peace than he does the reign of Jesus. And so instead of recognizing the true king of not just the Jews, but the Gentiles, he turns him over to be crucified. Now, the soldiers lead him away, and they call together the whole battalion. This is about 600 people, and they begin to mock Jesus. And this is where the heavy irony that we've seen in Mark really kind of jumps up to a new level, because here is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords being honored in a twisted and debauched manner. They're saying, hey, he's the king. And then they weave together a crown of thorns and slam it down on his head. And they give him purple robes, which would have been royalty. And they had a reed, which would have been analogous to a scepter that a king would have had, and they're beating him with it. This is public shaming, the likes of which we in our comfortable American culture don't really have a category for. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine this sort of universal public scorn where they take something that's true and then they twist it and they treat it as if it's a joke and then they mock you with it. And this is what Jesus is suffering. At the end of this, they stripped him, they put his clothes on him, they led him out to crucify. Earlier, going back to your question over here, they had him scourged. What scourging is, it's a whipping. And typically when you use a scourge, there's a heavy leather or metal ball and then a little tail with a spike on it. And it does two things. It tenderizes and it punctures at the same time. This would have been absolutely brutal. And the scourging combined with the mocking was one of the reasons that Mark tells us they had to get somebody else to bear Jesus' cross, which is kind of the next part of our story here. But it's worth mentioning that the Bible specifically mentions that this would happen to the suffering servant. In Isaiah chapter 53, we read this, "But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed." That was Isaiah 53, Isaiah chapter 53, verse 5. This text makes it very clear that Jesus was mocked and scourged and beaten for you. It's by those very wounds that the punishment that should have fallen on us doesn't come anymore. It falls on to somebody else. So, Jesus is being led out to be crucified at this point, and he has been beaten so badly he doesn't have the strength to carry his own cross. And so the text tells us that they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and then they name him as the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, there's not a direct, irrefutable, definitive link here, but it seems likely that Rufus here is the same Rufus that's mentioned in Romans chapter 16, where Paul says, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, also his mother, who has been a mother to me as well." Mark's probably intentionally mentioning this name because it's important and known to the Gentile church in Rome, to whom is his audience. So, what's interesting about this retelling of Simon bearing the cross? This is still the part of the show where I ask you the questions. You guys get to ask questions next. I don't know if the text makes it clear. I didn't see any clarity on that one. Oh, maybe. This is a picture of discipleship. Take up your cross and follow me. Remember, Mark's not writing these events as they happen, right? He's not giving us a blow by blow. He's sat down and he's wrote this book for us, knowing that if you're reading the beginning, you're going to get to the end. And so he's putting pictures for us, ideas, in the beginning of his book that get picked up later. And At the same time, those later fulfillments or living parables point back to help us interpret the previous things. So Mark has said specifically, if you're going to follow Jesus, you must pick up your cross daily and follow him. This text shows us a picture of what that picking up the cross daily looks like. And it's not exactly pretty, is it? This is an entering into the public shame and crucifixion that Jesus is going through. And I think it's wise that we remember that's the picture of the Christian walk, and not to gloss over it or think of it too lightly. This is not true for all of us here. Don't hear me say that nobody in this room suffers. I know that's not true. I've been with many of you in the counseling room. But the reality is, we oftentimes talk of bearing our crosses in a way that's not the way that Mark's audience would have understood bearing our crosses, right? We facetiously maybe joke around bearing our crosses as the line at Starbucks was too long, so I didn't get my coffee this morning. Or the barista got my order wrong, right? I didn't get my daily dose of caffeine. But that's not bearing one's cross, according to Jesus, or according to Simon, or according to Mark. It's a whole lifestyle entering into the mission of Jesus regarding the shame as something that's worth bearing for the glory that awaits, like Jesus does. And so it's worth asking ourselves, are we really bearing the cross that Christian discipleship demands? And if not, why not? What might that look like for you? Okay, so we have this image of bearing the cross, and then we get to a number of things that show some fulfillment and bring life to previous passages in Scripture. So the water mixed with wine here at Jesus' crucifixion is, again, another form of mocking. You see, what happens when a king ascends his throne and is coronated is he gets the victory cup of wine. And so this is not just a painkiller, as some have proposed. It's another form of mockery. Hey, King of the Jews, here's your victory cup. Drink it up. They're continuing to heap shame and ridicule on Jesus. This draws our minds back to Psalm 69, 19 through 21, which says, "You know my reproach and my shame and my dishonor. My foes are all known to you. Reproaches have broken my heart so that I am in despair. I looked for pity, but there was none, and for comforters, but I found none. They gave me poison for food, and for my thirst, they gave me sour wine to drink." So here they are, mocking the King of Jews with a poisonous, bitter cup of quote-unquote victory. There's another fulfillment in Psalm 22, 16 through 18. "For dogs encompass me, a company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." This text was ultimately fulfilled with Jesus when they crucified him, took his garments, and cast lots for them. For the Roman crucifixion, the guards and the soldiers who completed the gory task would divide the person who was being crucified. They would divide their garments and whatever else they had on them. It was kind of their charge or their tip. And so that's why they're casting lots, right? Not all articles of clothing or possessions are equally valuable. Somebody wants the cloak. Nobody wants the ratty sandals, right? And so that's what's happening here at the base of the cross, is these soldiers are casting lots, throwing dice to see who gets the best part of Jesus' possessions. This is the last thing I want to say, and then I'll open it up for questions. What we see in this mockery is this, as I said before, it's a twisting of something that's real. And it's making a mockery of it. And I would suggest to you that you and I can be in danger of doing the same thing. You see, the Romans and the Jews who are mocking him were proclaiming Jesus to be King of the Jews, right, in bad faith. And that was made known by their actions. But there's a sense in which sometimes you and I can be guilty of the same things. We proclaim Jesus as Lord, and yet he has no authority in our hearts. We say we worship this King of Kings and Lord of Lords, but our lives, if we really looked at them, might proclaim something very different. We're entering into the same thing where we say he's king, and yet it's simply just words. We don't bring every aspect of our lives and hearts under his dominion. We continue, in some senses, to be rebels. And in so doing, we violate one of the greatest commandments. We take the name of the Lord in vain. We take his name by saying, we ourselves are Christians, little Christs. And yet we don't pick up our crosses daily. We don't lead with forgiveness. We don't have a posture of humility and servant-heartedness like Jesus does. And so this is a point that I think Mark presses in his gospel a number of times. And it's a point that's pressed on us through this text. Who do you say Jesus is? And does your life actually reflect that reality? Or does it make a mockery of that confession? Okay, that's the final pastoral note for you guys in our time together tonight. Are there any other final comments or notes you want to make before we close our time? Over here first.
You said at the beginning that the Jews could not administer the death penalty.
Yes.
But could they, according to Exodus, they could stone Jesus for blasphemy, right?
They could do it according to Old Testament law. But because of the political climate, Rome reserved the right for capital punishment. And so, especially during a feast time when there was lots of Roman guards, probably, it's not really something that they were going to be able to get away with. Yeah, the question is, how did they get away with stoning Stephen? And I was just thinking about that as I was talking. And I don't know. My guess is it was either a different time as in time of the year. So there wouldn't have been the political tension that's already there. And they were able to get a little leeway. It may have been that particular place. Yeah, I don't know. I'll just leave it at that.
Does it change your picture of discipleship that Simon was compelled, kind of like voluntold?
Yeah, not really. It's still the picture that I think Mark's impressing upon us is the hardship of the cross. The willingness, I think, is a different aspect that's covered in other places. But it's the difficulty, the public shame, the radical nature of that call that's being emphasized. Yeah?
So in Mark, it talks about both the thieves that were, or the people that were...
Is this in the next section?
No,
sorry. Yes.
But in another gospel, it talks about the one that asks Jesus.
Yes. Yeah. So I think the answer to that is both started out the same way, right? We know even from the other texts that at the beginning, both were reviling him. But Jesus didn't crucify and then die in an instant, right? Crucifixion was a long and painful process. For some people, it took up to 2 or 3 days for them to die while they were hanging there. And so one of those thieves, obviously, one of those other people who were being crucified, had a heart change while he was up there. Yeah? Yes? Yes. That's a great question. I hadn't thought about that. It makes for interesting bookends for Jesus' story. All those things are true. Anything else? All right, friends. That's enough conviction for me tonight. Let's hop on off to our groups. And we'll see you one more time.